Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Friday, April 19th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
Thanks, Rachel, and we'll begin with this front page article entitled Ben and Honor, Rock Island Police Chief Landy Retiring. This written by Grace Hunnicutt, or Kennicutt, writer for the Quad City Times. Serving in law enforcement was always the plan for the Rock Island Police Chief. And after more than three decades serving in law enforcement, Rock Island Police Chief Richard Landy will retire on Saturday, April 26th. In an embargoed interview with the Dispatch Argus Quad City Times last week, Landy said he began his career with Rock Island Police on September 20th, 1993. I knew this law enforcement was the job I always wanted to do, Landy said. The city announced his retirement on Thursday, April 18th. In the announcement, Mayor Mike Thomas thanked Landy for years of dedicated service to serving the community. His dedication and commitment has led to a decrease in crime, improved community relations, and an increase in efficiencies across the department, Tom said. We congratulate Chief Landy on a job well done and wish him well on his retirement. Landy's career in law enforcement started a few years before joining Rock Island Police Department. He served as an auxiliary police officer in Milan and in Mercer County Corrections. It would take testing two different times before he would finally become an officer for Rock Island, he said. At the time, there was lots of competition for the job, Landy said. People would test everywhere to get on as many lists as possibly. And he knew that he wanted to stay in Illinois, which he has kept to, spending his entire law enforcement career in the state. He recalled his first night on third shift and being told to grab his riot helmet, which was still in the box. He was sent to patrol downtown, he said, and when the bars would close, people were rowdy and would often throw things. There was also a night he was working and someone was shot, he said. It was different, different time back there then. I remember thinking to myself, what did I get myself into? Over his career with Rock Island Police Department, he made his way through the ranks, serving as a patrol officer, sergeant, lieutenant, and deputy chief. When former chief Jeffrey R. Van Huysen retired at the end of October 2021, Landy took over as interim chief before being named to the permanent position in April 2022. Becoming chief was not something he initially planned on. Being responsible for about 75 officers and guiding an entire city department can weigh on the chief. The decisions are yours. I'm responsible for all of them, and those decisions can weigh on you, he said. But the position has been one of the best. Overall, this has been one of the most satisfying positions, Landy said. We are like family. Landy attended Blackhawk College for Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice and received his certification from the University of Illinois Police Training Institute for Basic Correctional Officer, Basic Law Enforcement Officer, and Master Firearms Instructor. Significant times in history, such as Rodney King, 9/11 and George Floyd, have shaped how police departments have grown and adapted to change, Landy said. There was also the COVID-19 pandemic, which changed just about everything about doing the job, especially when it came to interacting with coworkers in the community. But for all the challenges the police department has experienced, there have been numerous good things that have come out of these hard times. The growth and improvement of technology has been the biggest blessing in helping the department adapt to change and the demands of society, he said. Landy recalled an early point in his career when officers were sharing flashlights because there was not enough for everyone to have their own. Nowadays, he reassured, there are enough flashlights and other personal gear and equipment to go around for each officer. Body cameras also have been a plus. When an officer out on a call hasn't contacted dispatch in a while, the Rock Island Emergency Communications Center can pull the officer's body camera up to find their exact location and even pull open the live feed from the camera, he said. Body camera footage also is uploaded to a system the police department uses, so the footage can be reviewed as needed. License plate readers and traffic cameras also have helped, Landy said. License plate readers, which were installed in 2023, have made it easier to catch stolen or wanted vehicles. There also was the move from the downtown police station to the new one at 1212 Fifth Avenue in 2015. At the old station, he said, the department was packed in. He was glad when city officials committed to building the new station. The use of social media, he said, also has made it easier to connect and continuing building trust with the community. Social media was vital to staying connected with the community during the pandemic. The police department also will often host coffee with a cop at a few of their favorite locations to interact with the community, Landy said. Officers also stop and just say hi and talk with residents or get out and play with some kids if time allows. That face-to-face interaction helps build trust, he said. You get more of a feel with them, the residents, and the community. He also said they work to maintain relationships with organizations around town, such as Family Resources. Rock Island Police Department has teamed up with Family Resources to provide services for the gun violence intervention strategy. The police department, he said, worked with the Davenport Police Department to implement the program in Rock Island. Group violence intervention, or GVI, is a strategy in which community members, social service providers, and law enforcement work together to prevent and intervene before a violent crime occurs. The strategy focuses on the fraction of a percent of the population driving violence by delivering credible moral messages against violence and enlisting community members, social service leaders, and law enforcement. This will change how we go about it, addressing violent crimes, Landy said. Usually it's always been they get in trouble, go into the system, and then receive services. With GVI, Landy said, a person will be assigned to help and to keep the individuals on track and guide them. The GVI strategy was a goal Landy wanted to implement during his time as chief. He also wanted to conduct an audit of all the 21,000 plus pieces of evidence in the evidence warehouse. The audit took about 2 weeks, he said, and it was the first time a full evidence audit has been done. The next thing is to clear the office for whoever will eventually take over as the next Rock Island Police Department chief. Police memorabilia, such as photos on the wall and art, will come down, and all that will be left is countless binders and paperwork ready for whoever the next chief might be. Plans for an interim chief have yet to be announced. As for now, Landy said he and his wife plan on downsizing their house His wife, he said, will be retiring from Recom this June. Landy said he met his wife through work. She was, and still is, a dispatcher, and he was an officer at the time. Though he is looking forward to relaxing and getting some traveling in with his wife, Landy said he will miss the people he works with because they are like family at the end of the day. The community should take comfort in how well we work together. It has been an honor to work here.
Project Now holds poverty conference. This by Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times. Project Now held its second annual Rooting Out Poverty Conference Thursday, urging communities to chart a new course and explore innovative ideas to end poverty. "What if I told you that poverty is unacceptable?" said Dwight Ford, executive director of Project Now. "Let's get to work and roll up our sleeves. If the Quad Cities starts to mobilize and stand up, tell poverty we are coming." Thursday's conference featured three core panels and a keynote speaker during lunch. George Guy, president of the National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, gave the keynote address titled, "Creating a Pathway Out of the Housing Crisis." The panels and panelists were Panel 1 on Justice, Unlocking Potential, Unleashing Possibilities, Ending Permanent Punishments, Creating a More Just Society and Safer Communities. That was chaired by Reverend Sierra Bates Chamberlain, Executive Director of Live Free Illinois, and Harry Pina and Shamir Love of the Illinois Coalition to End Permanent Punishments. Panel 2 was Education and Training, Gateway to Opportunity, Inspiring Change Through Youth Career Development and Training. That was led by John Patey, Chief Expansion Officer for the Community and Economic Development Association of Cook County, Rufus Greer Jr., Executive Director of Youth Build Quad Cities, Noe Omar Martinez Guzman, a Youth Build student from Rock Island, Susan Stanley, Operations Coordinator for the California Indian Manpower Consortium. And then panel 3 was Health and Economics, Community by Design, Innovative Approach to Investing in People and Places. And that was led by Anderson Saintsy, Director of the Office of Shared Prosperity and Neighborhood Support, Sanjitha Rayaputi, Mayor of Moline, Ashley Ezio and Michael Berger, Project Coordinators for Uplift Iowa, and Thurgood Brooks, Coordinator of Rock Island's West End Revitalization. In his opening address, Ford cited the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964, which led to a 42% decrease in the nationwide poverty rate by 1973. "We have to see what they saw back then," Ford said. "Poverty is what it is, a thief. It steals opportunity, it divides people, and it separates people by race and economic status." To him, the first step toward rooting out poverty is forming relationship-based personal responsibility. He said, "We have to strip this mindset that people are in poverty because they don't work hard or are lazy and shiftless," adding someone could work overtime and then some and still come up short in the United States. He went on, "Nobody writes a 15-year plan for their life and says, I look forward to sleeping on the street, or I look forward to eating out of trash cans. I look forward to a life of addiction and wasting all my resources." What does this say about us? If we only believe that personal responsibility has everything to do with them and not with us. Along with urging the public to adopt this mindset, Ford said, "Better public policy is another step. I'm not asking you to ride on the back of a donkey or stampede on the shoulders of an elephant. I'm asking you to stand up for people that need us most. When a policy hurts poor people, we should stand up." Ford passed the mic to Stormy Udell of the Illinois Association of Community Action Agencies for a brief presentation on how agencies can use networking and innovation strategies to make more of an impact in their communities. Next, attendees learned how prison education programs give formerly incarcerated individuals a chance to reach and expand their potential. Hearing firsthand from Augustana College students, T.Y. Stone and David Staples, the two spoke about their transition from prison back into their home communities and Augie's campus. Both are members of the first Augustana Prison Education Program cohort. As previously reported, that cohort offers a full-time bachelor's degree program to prisoners in the East Moline Correctional Center. The program currently enrolls 29 students and offers majors in communications or American studies, taught on-site by 30 Augie faculty members. Stone and Staples spoke about the transformative power education had throughout their journeys, both in and out of prison. Staples, now 60, spent 29 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. Before he was exonerated with help from the Illinois Innocence Project, a statewide nonprofit seeking justice for wrongly incarcerated people, Staples said that the education program gave him hope. Executive Director Sharon Varallo said the program is seeking sponsorships for the following majors and minors: economics, business, public health, and data analytics. She said prison education is good by every metric, noting reduced rates of recidivism, family reunification, and children's education and stability, improved mental health, and skilled labor force support. Alexis Ritchie, an Illinois coordinator for the Supportive Housing Providers Association, initially attended Thursday's conference to learn about housing affordability, but she had personal insight on other items as well. Her brother spent 25 years incarcerated, she told the Quad City Times Dispatch Argus, so hearing similar stories from Thursday's panelists gave her a sense of hope. When he came home, every door you could think of was being shut because he was a convicted felon, Ritchie said. The cycle of poverty in black and brown communities is so overwhelming. We have too many barriers and not enough resources and solutions to help these individuals give back to society in a productive manner. She hopes housing industry leaders such as landlords, developers, and mortgage brokers who attended Thursday's conference feel inspired to start making affordable housing more accessible to those with felony convictions. Everyone deserves a second chance, Ritchie said. My hope is that action will happen sooner rather than later. Rock Island Alderman Dylan Parker from Ward 5 plans to use Thursday's conference to gauge how the city can improve. He said local government is where the rubber hits the road, right? So it's important to understand both what resources are available to local governments and community needs. Rock Island is arguably the poorest of the Quad Cities communities, so unfortunately I see this pretty frequently. I came here not to be educated as to the need, rather to identify what can be done. Parker said the justice panel made him reflect on Rock Island's hiring practices for formerly incarcerated applicants, along with other types of programs the city could implement. He said we need to be doing more in Rock Island to address below-the-hill neighborhoods, rather than continuing to push them westward and hoping, I don't know, they fall off into the river or something, he said. Redlining existed in Rock Island half a century ago, and that continues to reverberate now. I'm here today to figure out how to create solutions to finally break these systems.
Thanks, Rachel. We have an article here, Homer Man Enters Guilty Plea. This written by Lisa Hammer of the of rhhammer15@gmail.com. This comes from Cambridge. A Homer, Illinois man entered a negotiated guilty plea to one count of criminal sexual assault and two other felonies in Henry County Circuit Court Wednesday. Timothy P. Hopping, 25, entered the plea to the Class 1 felony and was sentenced to 4 years in prison, to be served at 85% or 3.4 years, plus 3 years mandatory supervised release. He was given credit for 166 days served in the county jail, which also erased his fines for the felonies. That sentence will be consecutive to a 3-year prison sentence for violation of an order of protection and a 4-year sentence for aggravated battery of a correctional institution employee. The latter two sentences are to be served concurrently or at the same time. According to Hopping's plea for criminal sexual assault, officials were dispatched to a Woodhull home on November 1, 2023, where a woman indicated Hopping was waiting in her home for her and physically overpowered her, committing an act of sexual penetration. In a victim impact statement read to the judge by Henry County State Attorney's Catherine Runty, the woman stated she suffers from nightmares nearly every night. The felony carried a mandatory prison sentence of 4 to 15 years. Three other related charges, Class X felony home invasion, Class 4 felony violation of an order of protection, and another count of Class 1 criminal sexual assault, were dismissed on the motion of the state. Hopping also pleaded guilty to violating an emergency order of protection, which was granted February 28, 2023. The petitioner received a text message from Hopping's cell phone number on March 1, 2023. He had two prior convictions for unlawful violation of an order of protection from Knox County in 2018. A Class 4 felony charge of obscene message and a Class A misdemeanor charge of violation of an order of protection were dismissed. The charge of aggravated battery to a correctional employee stemmed from a November 2023 incident in which jail staff told Hopping to get rid of trash and food in his cell, and a physical struggle ensued in which he punched a correctional employee in the head. A Class A misdemeanor charge of resisting a police officer was dismissed. Judge Terry Patton accepted the plea agreement.
Two other crime-related stories. Man sentenced in injury crash case. This is by Anthony Watt. A Rock Island man must serve a sentence in an Illinois prison in relation to a serious injury crash in Moline. The collision happened early on February 12, 2023, in the 4400 block of River Drive, according to previous reporting. Three people suffered broken bones. Prosecutors accused Terrence Pipes, age 37, of being impaired by at least cannabis and alcohol while driving a 2021 Nissan Versa, according to previous reporting. He attempted to pass a vehicle and collided with an oncoming Chevrolet Cruze. Each vehicle had two occupants. Pipes received sentences of 4 years each on two counts of aggravated driving under the influence, court records state. Pipes will serve the sentences at the same time or concurrently. He will get credit for time served, and he also qualifies for day-for-day credit on the sentence, court records state. The day-for-day credit could further reduce the actual time he spends incarcerated. The Rock Island County State's Attorney Office initially charged Pipes with 9 counts of aggravated driving under the influence for the crash, according to previous reporting. He pleaded guilty to the 2 counts in January after reaching an agreement with prosecutors. The remaining charges were dismissed. A lawsuit related to the crash filed on behalf of Jane A. Edwards names Pipes as a defendant, court records state. The suit states that Edwards was the other driver and accuses Pipes of negligence. It remained pending as of Thursday. And then this, man arrested for robbery on high-end purses by Tom Lowy. A Cincinnati man faces multiple felony charges for last July's robbery of a store in Davenport's North Park Mall. Brandon Lamar Hardin, age 18, is charged with conspiring to commit a forcible felony and second-degree robbery, both felonies. He also faces a misdemeanor charge of assaulting a police officer. Police allege that at 4 p.m. on July 8, 2023, Hardin entered a store in the North Park Mall with co-conspirators. They intended to steal high-end purses, according to affidavits. Investigators say Hardin entered an employee-only area and removed high-end bags from the glass case and shelf, then tried to run out of the store. An off-duty police officer in the store attempted to intervene and identified himself as Davenport Police to Hardin. The affidavits allege Hardin fought the officer. Hardin allegedly hit the officer in the left eye with a fist, causing injury. Police say Hardin ran from the store, entered an SUV with stolen license plates, and fled the scene. The affidavits say Hardin stole over $2,000 worth of purses. Investigators learned Hardin and co-conspirators traveled in a rental vehicle from Cincinnati, Ohio to Iowa in order to commit a series of felony thefts. Though the affidavits do not detail how investigators reached those conclusions. Investigators did say they believe Hardin is possibly linked to other crimes, but did not name him as a suspect in any other robberies or thefts. Purse theft also made headlines in the Quad Cities in October of 2023 after a number of suspects stole designer purses from the Bag Broker in Davenport. Davenport police responded to a burglary alarm at about 5 a.m. on October 2, 2023, at Avail, the Bag Broker, at 5515 Utica Ridge Road. Police found the suspects entered the store by breaking a window. The robbers smashed glass display cases and made off with about $175,000 worth of designer purses and handbags. No arrests have been made in the October theft.
And we have this article written by Lisa Hammer, Orion Schools iComputer Courses. The Orion School Board decided in March to learn more about adding a new computer concepts course, whether mandatory or not, to its curriculum. High school principal Nathan DeBailey gave a presentation to the board on the possibilities of adding more computer courses at the grade school, middle school, and high school levels. He said he had no recommendation, but the matter deserved more discussion. Key questions were, at what level would the district want to implement classes? Do high school students have enough space in their schedules to add the additional requirements? And how would the requirement affect the enrollments in other classes? DeBailey said. My opinion on that would be, what do you guys think would be best? Said Board President Aaron Kaiser, directing his comment to the administrators. Superintendent Joe Blessman suggested the board keep talking about adding classes to get the ball rolling and have it in place before scheduling next year for the fall of 2025. DeBailey also briefed the board on two new career pathways programs the high school is planning to add to fulfill requirements from the Illinois State Board of Education. The requirements are intended to make students more marketable when they go to find careers. He said Orion is planning an education pathway, offering an intro to education course this fall and hoping to expand to a second course. Between 5 and 10 students are reportedly interested in the program. A second pathways course doesn't need to be approved until 2028 to meet state requirements. But Orion is already working on an aviation technician course that it hopes to start in the fall of 2025. DeBailey said Elliott Aviation is committed to helping the district, and the course will also work a lot with drones.
You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. It's time to turn to the obituaries in today's paper. We have several pendings and then three obituaries. I'll read the pendings and the first obituary, and Jim will take the other two. In the pendings, K. Francis Beshore, age 77, of Davenport, died Wednesday, April 17th. Arrangements at Wirtz Funeral Home of Davenport. Carol Jean Krulik, age 79, of Muscatine, died on April 16th. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial. Elizabeth Ann Malone, age 85, of Bettendorf, died on Thursday, April 18th. Services pending at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home of Bettendorf. James, or Jim, William Metz, age 81, of Peoria, formerly of Rock Island, died on Wednesday, April 17th. Arrangements pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory of Rock Island. Mary Z. Prohl, age 83, of Milan, Illinois, died Wednesday, April 17th. Cremation directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial of Moline. Richard D. Siebert, age 92, of Moline, died on Thursday, April 18th. Arrangements pending at Rafferty Funeral Home of Moline. And Peggy A. Steerwalt, age 80, of Wilton, died on Tuesday, April 16th. Arrangements are pending at the Runge Mortuary. The first of the obituaries is for Geraldine Frisk Crabtree. Geraldine Frisk Crabtree, age 82, passed away on Friday, April 12th, at her daughter's home in Muscatine, Iowa, after a long battle with Alzheimer's. The Ralph J. Wittich Riley Frears Funeral Home will be in charge of all arrangements. There will be no services, but she will be interred at River Hills Memorial Park in Batavia, Illinois, at a future date. Online condolences may be made at thewittichfuneralhome.com. Geraldine was born on January 10th, 1942, in Geneva, Illinois, the daughter of Rudy and Ida Frisk. She graduated from Naperville, Illinois High School, went on to college, to marry, and to have two children. Geraldine graduated with her master's degree in adult education from Northern Illinois University. She moved to the Quad Cities to work professionally. She was first at Black Hawk College in Moline and later Scott Community College in Bettendorf. In addition to holding the position of Student Support Services Director, she loved to work with students and taught many master student classes. Geraldine retired from Scott Community College in 2002 to pursue the dream of being a full-time artist. Geraldine is survived by her ex-husband, Dennis, and her wife-in-law, Susan Crabtree, of Arizona. Children Christine Crabtree Compton of Iowa, Stephen Crabtree and his wife Roxanne of Illinois. Foster children Griselda Padilla of Illinois and Thunga Pham of Florida. Five grandchildren and one great-grandchild. She was preceded in death by her parents and older brothers, Douglas and Gerald Frisk.
And we have Margaret Bernadine Bettini. Margaret Bernadine Bernie Bettini passed away on April 17, 2024, at 103 years old. She was a beloved mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother who will be greatly missed. A mass of Christian burial for Bernie will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. Monday, April 22nd at St. Anthony's Catholic Church in Davenport. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery, Davenport. Visitation will be held from 9:30 until 10:30 a.m. at the church. Halligan McCabe DeVries Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. She was born in 1920 in Davenport to Michael, Joseph, and Agnes Dwyer Leonard. During World War II, she enlisted in the U.S. Coast Guard in 1945 and served as a yeoman until 1946. She married Joseph G. Bettini in 1950, and they had a happy marriage for 65 years living in Davenport. She is preceded in death by her husband, Joe, her daughter, Gina Marie Bettini, Major, her parents, her brothers and sisters, John Ray and Kay Leonard, sister Mary Aquin, Virginia Martin McCarthy, Joseph Irene Leonard, and Frances Mary Louise Leonard. She is survived by her sister, Jean Ann, spouse Jerry Tan of Davenport, and by her six children, Colleen Bettini, New Berlin, Wisconsin, Ann Brockle, of Genesee, Wisconsin, Meg Wollery, Donahue of at Donahue, Iowa, Brian Bettini of Davenport, Angela Ray, Middle Amana, Iowa, and Kay Patch of Davenport. She greatly enjoyed her 14 grandchildren and is also survived by 13 great-grandchildren. Memorials may be made to St. Anthony's Church, Davenport, and online condolences may be expressed by visiting www.homewoodrhmdfuneralathome.com. And then finally, we have Diane R. Schmidt. Services for Diane R. Schmidt, 78, of Davenport, will be held at 2 p.m. on Saturday, April 20th, at the McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday at the funeral home. Memorials may be made to the family. Graveside services will be at 10 a.m. on Monday, April 22nd, at the Rock Island National Cemetery. Those wishing to attend should meet at the funeral home by 9:30 a.m. on Monday. Diane was born in Davenport on November 17, 1945, to Mercy, Mike, and Irene Meroto Brisco, and was a 1965 graduate of Davenport Central High School. On August 1st, 1992, she was reunited in marriage to Donald A. Schmidt in Pleasant Valley, Iowa. He preceded her in death on August 4th, 2017. Diane was employed as a contract specialist at the Rock Island Arsenal, retiring on June 30th, 2011, after 37 years of faithful service. She was a committee member of Big River Conservationists and an avid bowler for many years. After her bowling group began to bowl less often, she continued to get together with her friends for weekly euchre games. She enjoyed playing cards and loved Whitey's ice cream. Those left to honor her memory include her daughters, Tammy Hart of Davenport and Vicki McDonald of Stratton, Maine. Her sons, Dave Schmidt of Bettendorf, John Schmidt of Rock Island, Robert Schmidt of Bluegrass, and John Kuhnfair of Davenport. 16 grandchildren, 8 great-grandchildren, her sister Linda Kessler of Spokane, Washington, and her brother-in-law Robert Emmert of Fayetteville, North Carolina. In addition to her husband, she was preceded in death by her sisters, Marge Emmert and Bertha Jansen. Condolences may be breast to the family by viewing her obituary at www.mcginnischambers.com.
That completes the obituaries in today's paper, so it's time to turn to the opinion page. And Tom Martin, the executive editor of the Quad City Times, writes this column titled, "Tell Us About Your Favorite Teacher." A group of Comanche High School students toured the Quad City Times on Friday. Teacher Annette Blum reached out and set up the visit. The students, in expressive writing class, were greeted by executive editor Tom Martin and spoke briefly with President Rob Kravaritis before talking to reporters and photographers in the newsroom. From there, Tom Heidgerken from production gave a tour of the press, pre-press, press room, and warehouse facilities. Ms. Blum sent me some of their impressions of the visit. She said students were surprised by the size of the press and how much went into printing the newspaper. The students were also surprised to learn about the digital analytics, such as optimizing headlines for search engines, so a person's Google search will bring up a Quad City Times or Dispatch Argus news story. Blum said they didn't realize this job even existed and that businesses could find a way to maximize how often a site pops up during a search. For each news story we write, three headlines. One is for print. It has to fit the parameters of the space provided on the assigned page. A second headline is for the web and is aimed at enticing readers to click on the story. A third headline is mostly for search engines and requires key words that people may use to search for information. Blum said some students like seeing how the newspaper has been able to adjust to the internet and change reporting to better fit the needs of the people who want the news. They also found it interesting that so many people still subscribe to the newspaper in print rather than reading the news online. Finally, Blum said students thought it sounded like a fun job to be a reporter because you get to leave the building and talk to people. It was fun having visitors. Explaining what we do is a helpful exercise. So who's your favorite teacher? I come from a family of teachers and have seen what goes into being a good one. Teacher Appreciation Week is May 6th through 10th, and I'd like to invite readers to send in a blurb about a favorite teacher by May 1st. Include your name and current town or city of residence and follow this format I used for my favorite teacher. Favorite teacher, Karen Ehrig. What class and where? Composition, Hamilton High School, Hamilton, Illinois. What made this teacher stand out? I was a quiet kid and didn't draw much attention in class, but Mrs. Ehrig seemed to notice me and my work. As a freshman in high school, I was interested in Al Capone and organized crime during Prohibition, and she urged me to make that the focus of one of our larger writing assignments. She made a big deal about my paper, which made me feel like I could write. Suddenly, I wanted to write more. She encouraged me and so many students over decades to write. Please keep that section about what made this teacher stand out to less than 100 words. What he just wrote is 86 words. Email your favorite teacher blurb using the above format to newsroom@qctimes.com or press@qconline.com. Put favorite teacher in the subject line. We'll publish them all online and as many as space allows in print during Teacher Appreciation Week. Then see our news photos on Instagram and Facebook. Photographers Ray Dabner and Caitlin Metzger are regularly turning out high-end photo galleries. Those galleries are shared to Facebook, as are our stories and columns. Multimedia editor Grace Kinnicutt is adding some new approaches on social media. She started a throwback segment each Thursday, where she posts a few pictures from the archives. Instagram users might note that Grace has been sharing some of the photographers' favorite pics once or twice a day. We have great photographers, so we want to make sure everyone sees their work. Here are some of the recent photos. season opening night at Davenport Speedway, the Jesse Day Invitational Track and Field Meet, Rock Island Girls ABC Invitational, Quad City River Bandits versus Peoria Chiefs game, and the St. Ambrose Celebrates Dance and Cheer Championships. So that's the editorial by the executive editor of the Quad City Times, Tom Martin.
Thanks, Rachel. And here's an editorial written by Chris Kornoyer. She is the Iowa State Senator from the 35th District. Expanding public notices helps ensure transparency. As the chair of the Senate Technology Committee, one of my goals of the committee has been to utilize technology responsibly to make government more efficient, transparent, and accessible. Public notices have traditionally been printed in newspapers across Iowa, requiring a subscription to view in many cases. With dramatic changes in how people consume media, I saw a need to further expand public notices online where they could be easily accessed and even subscribed to, so citizens are notified via email when they are published. Through the legislative process, I was able to work with stakeholders to write Senate File 2331 that passed both chambers with overwhelming bipartisan support. This bill strikes a balance between tradition and innovation while maintaining our commitment to transparency, accountability, and civic engagement. If addresses deadline requirements make it easier for government agencies to fulfill their obligations, but more importantly, it preserves public notices in newspapers while also ensuring they are accessible in a digital format on local newspaper websites. Further, all notices will be posted on an independent statewide association website, and local governments are incentivized to also post to their own websites. The statewide site, www.iowanotices.org, is managed and maintained by the Iowa Newspaper Association. That website will allow citizens to search for and subscribe to public notices to stay informed. Public notices are important to the people of Iowa. They ensure transparency in government actions and decisions and serve as a safeguard for citizens' rights and interests. Our democracy depends on an informed citizenry, and newspapers play a role to verify that the notice was not altered once published. Newspapers also serve as an independent third party while providing the verification and archiving necessary to ensure that individuals' and taxpayers' rights are protected and preserved. It is important to reach as many Iowans as possible across both print and digital platforms. In working with representatives of the newspaper industry, we not only modernized the process, but were able to keep important content in local papers, something especially important for smaller community papers throughout the state. I know that healthy communities are ones in which their citizens are engaged in civic life. Safeguarding the tradition of public notices while advancing their accessibility is more than a matter of public policy. It is a commitment to the values of transparency and accountability that Iowans deserve.
There are four letters to the editor in today's paper, but I'm just going to share the fourth one because it's about the editorial page. In the decades in which I've been reading our two local newspapers, no editorial pages were as pleasing to read as those of the past month. In true Democratic fashion, between March 15th and April 15th, only 22% of the editorial columns were liberal, only 18% were conservative, and a whopping 60% were neutral, bipartisan, or non-political. and included in the liberal and conservative categories were the thought-provoking point-counterpoint debates that occurred in every Monday issue. Many of the columns seemed to have more substance than before, and more were about subjects of local concern. Thank you. In particular, Jonah Goldberg best exemplifies the Democratic approach. His thorough research and calm, objective style of writing enable him to discuss the strengths and weaknesses across the political spectrum. This style influences me and other swing voters far more than spewing one-sided propaganda, liberal or conservative. I hope this 32-day paradise won't be short-lived. Understandably, each side will likely trash the other side more and more severely as the election year rolls on. If they pollute our fabulous local newspapers in this way, I'll just skip reading those editorials and instead trundle out the relatively peaceful ones of the past month. That letter was sent to the editor by Luann Beinke of Rock Island.
Thanks, Rachel. And as we turn to sports, the sports that are being broadcast on television, let me give you, there's a whole bunch of them. Let me give you some of the highlights. College baseball, there's several games. On the Pac-12 network at noon today, Washington at Utah. ESPN2 at 6 o'clock, we have Florida at Vanderbilt. At 6:30 on ESPNU, we have TCU at Texas. At 7 o'clock, Penn State plays Michigan State on BTN, the Big Ten Network. And we have at 7 o'clock also on the Southeast Conference Network, LSU at Missouri. College football, they're televising the Louisville Spring Game at 6 o'clock tonight on ACC Network. College softball, there's several games being televised. We have at 4 o'clock Clemson at Notre Dame at ESPNU. At 5 o'clock, Washington at California on the Pac-12 network. At 5 o'clock also, LSU at Tennessee on FS1. That's on Southeast Conference Network. On FS1, we have Nebraska at Michigan at 6 o'clock. 7 o'clock, Arizona State at Arizona on the Pac-12 network. And at 9 o'clock, UCLA at Stanford on the Pac-12 network. Major League Baseball, 1 o'clock, Miami's at the Chicago Cubs on Marquee. 5:40, we got the White Sox at Philadelphia on NBC Sports Channel. 6:20, we've got Texas at Atlanta on Apple TV Plus. 7:15, Milwaukee at St. Louis, BSMW Network, and at 8:15, Arizona at San Francisco on Apple TV Plus. We have the NBA play-in, 6:10, the Eastern Conference, you got Chicago at Miami on ESPN, and at 8:30, the Western Conference, Sacramento at New Orleans, TNT. And the Olympic trials, 5:30 today, U.S. Wrestling Challenge Tournament on USA Network. We have an article on the local River Bandits. They run their winning streak to 7. This was a staff report, and they beat Peoria 1-0. More solid pitching performances led to yet another win for the Quad Cities River Bandits. As Ben Kudra, A.J. Block, and Ben Sears combined on a six-hitter Thursday evening, Dustin Dickerson's seventh-inning sacrifice fly proved to be the difference in a 1-0 rain-delayed Class A Midwest League victory over Peoria at Modern Woodman Park. The victory was the Midwest League leading ninth for the Bandits in their 12th start, as they have now won 7 straight heading into Friday's 4th game in the 6-game set. First pitch is scheduled for 6:30 p.m. back at Woodman Park on fireworks night. Thursday's contest was a classic pitcher's duel, as the teams combined for 10 hits, 9 singles, in the contest that lasted 2 hours, 11 minutes after a 46-minute delay to start. Peoria outhit the Bandits 6-4 in front of 670 fans. It was Quad City's third shutout of the season. The 20-year-old Kudnera, 1-1 record, no decision, continued his spectacular run, extending his strong stint of shutout baseball to 11 innings. He threw 5 frames of 3-hit ball. The lanky right-hander fanned 8, walked just 1. In 3 starts, the Shawnee Mission, Kansas resident, has struck out 19 batters and walked 5. Block followed with 2 innings of 1-hit ball as he walked 2 and struck out 2 in his third outing of the out of the bullpen this season. He picked up his first victory. Sears closed out the game for his second save in 4 appearances. He allowed 2 hits and stranded a runner at third in the 8th. A leadoff single in the 9th was wiped out on Quad City's second double play of the evening.
And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today, Friday, April 19th. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. And thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.